Bit about the Torah of the Rosh Hashiva. So tonight, we do two things. I want to share a sicha of Rav Lichtenstein from the 90s in Parshas Vayechi. I'm actually going to read parts of the sicha for you. The office was closed. I'll just, you know, a short quote. I'll send it to you afterwards on the WhatsApp. And I'll talk about what you should be thinking about as an extension of that, as an outcome of that. And then I'll talk about something else in the Parsha and how that can apply. So two issues about life in yeshiva, but about life in general. And particularly at this stage, it's January, halfway through, believe it or not, in some ways it can be more than halfway through. Time is really slipping through, so you really got to grab it, use it as best as possible. Okay, the first thing, the first part of the night shiur, Rav Lichtenstein's Sicha, again, mid-90s, is when Yaakov gives the brachos to his children. I've spoken about it a lot this week, I spoke about it last night. For a strange reason, he calls everyone into the room together. And this is something you expect to be much more private and intimate and personal, your last conversation with your father. And in particular, because it's not all sunshine and rainbows. He's critiquing Reuven, he's lambasting Shimon and Levi. So wouldn't it be more tender and sensitive to be critiquing them in private? So I spoke about it last night, and I spoke about the pasuk of Isha Sherki Berchos Abarachosam, that after he distributed brachos to the respective children, you get the strength of a lion, you get the cunning of a snake, you get the swiftness of a gazelle. He then said, everyone gets all those brachos. And it's a strange Rashi. Isha sherki brachosa berachosam. Like, if you give everyone the brachos, then why do you begin by specifying you're an Arya, you're an Nachash? If you shuffle the deck, why do you divide the deck? So there are different ways to understand that. Last night, for those of you who had the misfortune not to be at the greatest chug of the week, and those of you there talked about that, if when you form a community, part of the goal of a community and part of the, I build a ladder of achdus, the different rungs of achdus. What does achdus mean? Part of achdus is cross-pollination, where not every person can be involved in every sector of growth, and you cross-pollinate. So the Haredi sector, they're prodigiously producing tar. And most of the sperm we buy come from that sector, and it's incredible just to be able to benefit from the prodigious output of tar. And I talk just to show that, you know, it's all you can get from everyone. I also talked about secular Jews in Israel, and to a degree, secular Jews in America really believe that morality, social justice, social equality, building a more tolerant and respectful society, that is their Abrahamic mandate. That's the spirit of Abraham, of Avram. Do they believe in God? Maybe even Reformed Jews, maybe don't. Do they keep mitzvahs? And sometimes they remind us that we veer a little bit too much from that conversation sometimes. In Israel, I know politics are very polarized. And if you ask average Israeli, which parties stand for social justice and social equality and public welfare? They'll say left-wing parties. Because right-wing parties are associated with religion or with settlement. And since when did social justice become something that religious people aren't involved in and concerned about and people suffer? So they're taking an area that maybe we can't fully be involved in because we're so focused on the spiritual side or the, at least the ritual side. And anyway, so that's how I view it. When you have a community of cross-pollination, then each sector gains from another. So everyone in this community can gain from everyone else. Rav Lichtenstein talked about something a little bit different. That's tonight's first shiur. He talked about Yaakov telling his sons, just because you have a particular trait, I'm using my words now, and you'll hear Avaron speak in a moment, don't be trapped in those traits. Learn from other people and don't just grow from them. Oh, you have that trait, I'm going to benefit from it, but also try to acquire that trait. And Rav Aaron spoke to us about the balance, and you're old enough and been here long enough to know that everything's about balance. If you want to say, like, what's the topic of every single Musar Sicha? Balance. Okay, in certain areas, not balanced, in Avodas Hashem, not balanced, in Talmud Torah, not balanced, but in character development and traits and goals, it has to be balanced very, very carefully. So, should you focus on one area in life or in Talmud Torah to the exclusion of all else, where the yield will be excellence and achievement and growth? Or should you be more of a, you know, jack of all trades and diversify? And so, essentially, Yaakov is trying to position his children right in that sweet spot, where he says, you all have your specific traits, and I want you to excel in your lanes, but don't get stuck in your lanes. Learn to operate in everyone else's lanes also, and not just say, oh, that person will have the cunning of a snake, and I'll benefit from it, but also try to acquire, although that's not your trait, you're not done, but try to acquire part of it. So to set this up, let me quote from the translation of Rav Aaron Sicha. Remember, Rav Aaron gave the Sicha on Shabbos. This is an English translation. I was part of the team in the late 80s. This is the early, mid-90s sicha. I was part of the team in the late 80s. I would sit there after Shabbos with a couple of people. The first thing we did in Masech Shabbos, as we sat there, I got 4 or 5 guys together, and we wrote over all the shiurim and the lectures that were around to get over on Shabbos based on our memory.
And now thousands and thousands of people are listening to this Torah. So I really feel cool, like the order was. 1987, you know, writing the Divrei Torah down. Now it's 35 years later, people in Parshas Vayechi. So this is not mine, but this is, again, so this is not his exact words, but it's pretty close. People were sitting there, he said these words. That's how careful we listen to Rav Aaron. He said this word, that's how I was in these conversations. Did he say it this way? Did he say it that way? Again, we're translating from the Hebrew, but this is not just general. This is close to a translation of what he said. Okay, let me just pull that out. Again, I didn't get a chance to print it. I apologize. But listen, what?
Other people still do this?
I don't know. Again, remember, the output of the yeshiva of Shiurim now is so much more exponential than it ever was. I mean, I was just in the office today. I asked the person who's in charge of the YouTube. It's like, how many YouTube visits are there a week to the Yeshiva Torah YouTube? I think like 500. He says, oh, there are 14,000 people a week that come to the Yeshiva's YouTube channel for Torah. So there's just, you know, every week Rav Maidan gets 2,000 hits. You know? So I think that putting these texts out are a little bit seen as less necessary because there's frontal presentation and recording. In those days, it was nothing. So we tried to capture the Torah. Okay, so listen to Rav Aaron's quote. In the period of the Renaissance, just to show you how he's giving us framework and background, in the period of the Renaissance, up until the 17th century, there was a widespread cultural ideal. I'm sorry, my phone has a burn mark. There was a widespread cultural ideal of the Renaissance man, a person knowledgeable and capable in many fields. These people would show special interest and talent in one area, but would be capable in many. With the advance of science and technology, this model has changed. And in the more recent periods, there has been a much greater tendency towards specialization as opposed to man of all trades or Renaissance man. This is certainly understandable given the insurmountable vastness of the corpus of knowledge at our disposal. So much out there, you can't really specialize in everything. However, there's a price to be paid for this specialization. It is said that, this is a quote Rav Aaron would tell us very often, these days we are learning more and more about less and less, so that ultimately we will know everything about nothing. So they have the scatterbread. Let's just try to learn everything. And then you know nothing about anything, or everything about nothing. It's the same phraseology. While this is said in jest, there is some element of truth to it. In the last century, it became popular to write the history of one's own nation. One person wrote a 20-volume history of Italy. Well, apologies to Italians, only 20 volumes. And someone else wrote a 20-volume history of France. Today, a whole staff will work on researching a 50-year period in one country's history. There have been parallel developments in Torah scholarship. Great Torah scholars used to write works on a broad range of topics. Today, you will find lengthy treatises on one very narrow topic. Thick books on the ceremony of Hachnasas Sefer Torah, or in Tefillas Kelim. This has its advantages. If you want to learn about Hachnasas Sefer Torah, you can just go to the library at the computer, all the material in one place. Well, it may be a sign of enrichment to the library, it's a sign of weakness to the base matters. The people are just so uni-focused and they don't have the breadth. We need to strive, here's the balancing act, we need to strive for breadth of knowledge while achieving intense study of particular areas. Of course, we must learn as much Torah as we can, both in terms of breadth and depth. We cannot suffice with being specialists in one narrow area of Torah, but must attain broader familiarity and hopefully mastery of many areas. This principle obtains not only in Talmud Torah, but in religious life in general. It's crucial to maintain an area of intense focus while not ignoring or sidelining other realms of religious existence. So I'm sure a lot of boys are starting to think about this in the narrow sense, because in yeshiva, much of growth, challenge, identity, it happens later. In yeshiva, much of what you're thinking about is how can I schedule my day? How should I invest my time? And what factors should I take into consideration? And generally, there's a trend in the beginning of the year, because you see this is your 1 year to cover Kol HaTorah Kula. I'll learn 10 minutes of Tanakh, 10 minutes of Gemara, 10 minutes of Mishnah, 10 minutes of Kuzari, 10 minutes, and I'll finish Torah. Because that's how your mind is trained in high school. You want to finish physics, you divide and conquer. You divide up into parcels and you study physics. And then you're starting to realize that that's laughable when it comes to Torah. Not only is it laughable, but it's just incompatible. This is not your year to study Torah. This is your year to orient, condition, build skills, and orient your heart so that hopefully you have a lifetime of deep and rich Talmud Torah. So how do you balance between the two in Talmud Torah? Well, I certainly think, and now this is me speaking, obviously I'm finished quoting the Buchnasin, that there should be a massive focus on Gemara. Because this is really the one and only time in your life that you can acquire whatever you meant. We're not here to talk about extensively Gemara, but again, remember, you're not going to be learning Lamdas your whole life. More or less, Lamdas is going to end for you the second you leave the base matters. Now, some of you may stay your whole life in the base matters in some capacity.
But by and large, learning outside of the Beis Medrash is not the learning you're performing here. However, this yeshiva and similar yeshivas are based upon the notion that giving you that front row seat to why this whole system called Torah She'Bal Peh, it makes so much sense and is so riveting and is attracted the greatest minds. Let's face it, there's a lot of ambiguity out there, a lot of ignorance, and a lot of mocking of Torah She'Bal Peh. And when you start to mock Torah She'Bal Peh, then all of a sudden it bleeds into mocking Rabbanim. And at the core of our religion is the Samchus, the authority of Torah She'Bal Peh, and the Samchus of Rabbanim. So we want you to be able to see this system for all its beauty and majesty, even if you're never able to replicate the level of lumdus that you are this year. Every time you learn it, you realize you're touching the tip of something larger, deeper, meaningful, that great minds are dedicated day and night to, and you'll respect those people. And again, it's not all or nothing. Gemara learning is not either Bekiyas or Ian. It's a spectrum. So hopefully you'll have enough skills after a year or two of learning here, or certainly those who will learn a couple extra years during their college time. I can promise you, you're not necessarily every minute of your life going to have the time to delve into the Ritva and the Rashba. But when you read a Gemara and Daf Yomi, things are going to start clicking for you. Oh, yeah. Those two words, there's probably, because sometimes the lumdus leaps out at you, depending on how easy the topic is, depending on how clear the language is in the Gemara. But, we just learned, I know he's following Daf Yomi, we just learned, like last week, the Gemara Lamed Gimel M'sachin. When you eat Truma B'shogeg, do you pay the fee Dabim or the fee Amida? Do you pay based on the value? Do you pay based on the units? You're starting to see, you know, what's the chiyuv of Truma? Is it because you stole it, then you pay the value? Because you violated the Isser, like Nevela, then you... Like, doesn't take a big time. That's not like all of a sudden I'm disclosing secrets of lumdus. You want to disclose the door? It's pretty much out there. So you want to try to build a balance and in your life as well. I mean, I think that there has to be a part of Torah that you love and you follow. I have an old adage that I've been saying for 30 years. If you follow the road of passion, it will lead you to the palace of Torah. Like if you follow your passion, if you learn Torah because you're passionate about it, you're apt to invest more in it and you're just more all into it, and each person can find their own chelik in Torah. And I remember I was sharing with Israeli boys, Jason just closed it up, I was sharing with Israeli boys today that in the 80s, there was a very prestigious scholarship offered to serious Talmid Chachamim in yeshivas in Israel across the spectrum. In those days, it was $10,000 a year, which was beyond, extraordinary. You can't imagine $10,000 a year. And people applied to it from all over the Israel. And Rav Aaron Lichtenstein was on the board, the panel of Rosh Hashiva, who made the decisions, along with Rabbanim and Chevron. There was one boy who I see now. He's now a man. He teaches in Herzog. I don't see him now because of the Seger. And he excelled in Tanakh. He was known as a Tanakh guy. Then we had Tanakh questions. He went, whatever that was in his field. So he applied for the scholarship. Since he was from his own yeshiva, Rav Aaron had to recuse himself from the panel. So Rav Aaron wasn't on the panel, but he wrote a letter of recommendation for this Talmud to the Rosh Hashivas who were going to judge him. And his letter says that even though he's not learning Gemara and that's not his field, could you imagine if Rav David Kimchi, otherwise known as the Radak, who was a contemporary of the Rabbeinu Tam, had gone into Gemara? So we'd have Tosos, and he'd quote the Rabbeinu Tam in the Ri, and he'd quote the Radak, and we'd have another Bala Tosos. But he didn't. He went into Tanakh, and look how much wealthier and richer we are for having the Radak on Tanakh. So he'll be that equivalent in our generation. Do you think he got the scholarship? No. He didn't get the scholarship. Despite Rav Lichtenstein's letter of recommendation, because obviously in the yeshiva world, it just isn't as valued. And I'm not clocking in yes or no, I'm just describing a story. But if some of you decide, and you have to be really careful, that my area of learning is going to be Tanakh, or my area of learning is going to be Halacha, I'd be careful. I mean, Machshava, how much is Machshava is really Talmud Torah? Because you're dealing with some very, very basic sources, but they're very speculative. It's not like you're... So most of your time, you're trying to understand important concepts that can be very enriching, but how much of it could you call Talmud Torah? It's important, but not everything that's important is Talmud Torah, and a person has a chiyuv to learn Talmud Torah. So to be a little bit careful, Talmud Torah, it's an interesting question. Like, let's sit down and decide what's Talmud Torah. What do you have to make a bracha on? What can you not learn on Tisha B'Av? What can you or can't you learn in the bathroom? So for example, I have a book now for Rabbi Sachs, called Great Partnership, I think, is that one. I'm trying to go through that. Pretty much just that, I can read it in the bathroom. There's no, you know, it's a very riveting book, and I'm enjoying it. It's really enhancing my life. But there are a couple sources, and very, very general sources. Again, I would not read those sources in the bathroom. I'd go 30 pages, which is talking about morality and ethics and world religion and Greek views, and it's a really valuable book, but I could probably read that book on Tisha B'Av as well. So you have to distinguish between Now, sometimes I'll ask people, what are you learning? I'll say, I'm reading, you know, the book about the Six-Day War, reading the book about... Those are really important things, but in the end, you have to account for, are you being Osek in Talmud Torah? So I think it's important with Talmud Torah, but it's important in life in general, and that's much closer to what the Parsha talks about. To be able to excel in your traits and know yourself and know what traits Hashem gifted you with and how you can maximize them, and that takes massive, massive investment, self-awareness, honesty, but not to be in prison. I know a lot of boys at this age, it's easy to tag yourself and say, I'm this, and therefore I'm not that. And tagging yourself, not just labeling ideologically, which I've spoken about before, but developmentally. I'm this type of person, I'm not that type. And diversity and versatility, without diffusing your energy so much that you compromise the caliber. I think we can all say that high school thrives on diffusion. High schools are, by definition, diffusive environments. We go from class to class, club to club, environment to environment. I'm now interviewing, you know, all the boys who are applying for next year. And one of my questions is the clubs. And, you know, they're all trying to impress me. 16 clubs. And I'm on this, and I'm the editor of this. And my favorite one is on this, the editor-in-chief. So, like, does that give you the right to invade other newspapers? You know, like the commander-in-chief, exactly. Editor-in-chief of the newspaper. So, but look back at your high school experience critically and ask yourself, was the diffusion healthy? We're part of this wave of diffusion because high schools had to diversify because it used to be very, very narrow, boring, dark places where you came and learned mathematics from a 75-year-old German teacher who wrapped your equipment. Oh, so let's make high schools friendlier and more diverse and clubs and teams. And have we diversified too much? Are your high schools, so to speak, guilty of we know a lot about everything or nothing about anything? Or as a teacher who's a Talmud of mine from my school, is not really represented here, but once told me, I was once in high school, very prestigious high school, and I was giving a bechina. So I asked the boy, what are you learning? He was learning actually Kiddushin. I said, which daf? This is February. Which daf are you up to? I said, Daf Gimel. He said, Daf Gimel. I leapt out of my chair. I was shocked. I said, it's February, and you're up to Daf Gimel. So he looked at me, very sweetly, sweet boy. He said, but we skipped Daf Beis. I had a heart attack. Daf Gimel, you skipped Daf Beis. He looked four lines. So I hightailed it over to the Rebbe with my Talmud. I didn't say it in a harsh way, just like. And he started crying. His Rebbe looked at me, and tears were rolling down. He said, a very sensitive soul. He says, you don't understand. This is my schedule. Model UN, Torah Bowl, basketball team, skiing, retreat. He didn't say it vindictively. He just said, this is the reality of high schools today. So I have them, you know, I'm scheduled to have them for 45-minute periods once a day. It takes me 10 minutes on either end to, you know, take attendance and to close up shop. So I've got, you know, 30-minute period. And that falls. And it's not just a religious question. It's also like, there's a school that's not here this year. There's a 7th and 8th grade track named after Rav Lichtenstein that they're not in yeshiva this year. They started a program in conjunction with other schools. And they pulled up a very interesting experiment where the boys are here in yeshiva 2 or 3 days a week. And they have all their lingvei kodesh, blocks of time. In the base medrash with yeshiva boys. And then the other 2-3 days, they're in their regular schools learning the secular studies and topics. So there's an attempt to consolidate, even at the cost of... So these are interesting educational questions. They're also interesting developmental questions. To me, I'm more interested in the development because you're about to leave the religious educational framework. I mean, hopefully you won't ever stop educating yourself religiously, but at some point, most of you in the next couple of years, you will not be involved in formal educational setting. Okay, this year, next year, those who will be in Batei Medrash systems for college, but unless you continue on in Smicha, unless you continue on, by the way, a nice little plug for Smicha, I mean, it was not my intention, but I would love for the modern world to change the word Smicha or provide another way to refer to Smicha as graduate study in Torah. Like, let's say you decide to go to graduate school in business for an MBA, or in chemistry, you want to go into academia or engineering. You say, you know what? On the side, I want to get an MBA. I want to get a degree, a master's in literature or philosophy or psychology. This thing will make me a better person. Like, it would be totally acceptable. Everyone goes for 2 degrees at once. One is, depending on medical school, less so, but one is more intense, one is less intense. You realize there's one that I need for my profession, but I want to enrich myself on the side. So I'm going to study, you know, East Asian culture, East Asian literature or something. You're not going to teach East Asian literature, but you just want to read it. So shouldn't it be that serious B'nai Torah are able to take advantage, and today, especially with online, just say, I'm finished my college. I'd like to learn the next 4 years while I'm preparing myself professionally, while I'm preparing myself in marriage. And it's just a great framework to do it. I mean, there's a great framework of Lundus, but this is the framework that works. people your age that are preparing to be rabbis, I think it'd be a great thing. I really think that people should like store it away. Again, a lot depends upon, you know, if you're married at that point, at which point you have responsibilities at home, it'd be less feasible. If you're single, more feasible. If you're in medical school, less, law school, more feasible. So a lot of variables in the equation, but it's something to just put in the back of your mind to say, why can't I just learn Torah for a couple extra years beyond my college years? Anyway, that's the first thing I just wanted to put out there with Rav Lichtenstein. I'll try to post just the quote of Rav Aaron on the chat, and you'll be able to look at it. Okay. The second thing, which is my own, and it has nothing to do with, I don't think I heard this from Rav Lichtenstein, although I'm sure it was inspired by Rav Lichtenstein, is I don't have the pasuk in front of me, but it does, I'll just describe it. Yaakov is worried sick that he will be buried and entombed as a mummy in Egypt and enshrined as a deity. So he pleads with his son Yosef to remove him to Eretz Yisrael. And Rav Aaron did talk about this. One of the, if you have a chance, you want to see some of Rav Aaron's Torah on Vayechi, a lot of the Torah on Vayechi really highlighted human emotions, human interactions, relationships. It's something that people that didn't know him don't fully appreciate about him. People just read him from his lectures and shrimp think he was like a brain sitting on a table. That's why talking to you, a brain in a mouth. He was so sensitive and so kind and so compassionate and so emotionally intelligent, but he wasn't charismatic. He wasn't warm. He wouldn't put his arm around you and how are you doing? Come sit on my lap and tell me your story. It was a different persona. But when you got to know him, or when he spoke about it, he spoke with a lot of understanding, relationship, sensitivity. So if you read some of the Torah, I spoke about this on Sunday, if you want to listen to the Shir, it's on YU Torah, about Rav Aaron analyzing how do you build relationships. What's at the core of human relationships? Just a spoiler for those that are not going to listen to it. The two fundamentals of relationships are trust and communication. Now, those sound like cliches, but if you think about them really, really well, that's how you build relationships. You have to work hard. It's not easy. You have to work hard at building trust. Mental experiment. I just taught the girls in McDonald's, Israeli girls. Here's a good mental experiment. It really will help you understand. Okay? Don't tell me. Don't write the name down. But I'm sure you're all going to, at some point, smile. Inevitably, every single one of you, during your 18 or so, 19 years of life, you encountered a parent, counselor, or teacher, someone who's morally authority to you, who abused your trust. You lost trust in them. And the whole thing just flatline, your whole relationship flatline. You couldn't look at that person anymore. You couldn't game them. They lied to you. They manipulated you. They told you one thing. They backstabbed or something. If you didn't, you're lucky. You had a really good education. But inevitably, there's always that one person who makes you lose trust in them. And they're like, it's finished. It's over. I'm like, yeah, why should I listen to anything? Because who knows if what you're saying is because you really care or you don't care. Manipulative. I remember in high school, I remember that one rabbi who just did something terrible to me. Not criminal, I'm just saying. Something terrible, and just like, I couldn't, that was it. It all ended. Like, he gave me so much, and then relationship just ended because he went behind my back and told the prince, like, we were very close to me. So relationships about building trust is parenting, right? You really, really have to build trust in your kids. How do you build trust? That's a longer conversation. It's not simple, but how as a parent are you going to build trust in your kids so your kids can trust you? Reliability, punctuality, telling the truth, transparency, non-manipulating. It's really important. Otherwise, the relationship is an expert in. Anyway, getting back to the thing I wanted to speak about. So Rav Aaron spoke a lot in this week's Parsha about how mighty people, even mighty people, ultimately are dependent. We're all codependent. Yaakov is this mighty person. When he says that everyone respects him, he runs his... In the day, he's begging his son to take him to bury him. And Yosef, who's even more powerful and potent, he has to beg his brothers to pass down traditions hundreds of years later. So human achievement, human power, human ego, you know, it's all fleeting, it's all passing. We all need each other. It's a facade. We think we're strong. And just, here's my voice. Don't be impressed by people of power. Don't be impressed by people of, all human beings. No one is as, we live in a world of outsized personalities, the way they appear on the internet, the way they appear. Everyone's a human being. Everyone's just, Don't get lost and make people into self-deified humans. Yaakov begs Yosef to take him to Mitzrayim, but from Mitzrayim to Eretz Yisrael. And what does he tell him? He tells them to make a shvua. This is a very, very arresting moment. I mean, he's a son. And you'd expect Yosef, his son, to be pretty generous and sincere and committed, taking his father back based on his wishes. Akiva, do me a favor. Tonight, what's that mean? What's for dinner? Maybe a little hungry, but I want you to take a shavuot.
a little bit insulting. I mean, I think you like me. I think you respect me. I'm not asking too much. It's whatever proportion that I relate. I'm not asking you to get on a plane. I'm asking you just to, what's that mean? What's for dinner? I don't mean, I'm just saying. Yosef is so devoted to his father. Zivi, I mean, he's got the kisson on his bosom. That's caused all the problems to begin with. And Yaakov is asking to take a shvuah. It's insulting. Where did this occur earlier in Sefer Bereishis? With someone who's tasked with a mission, you'd expect him to perform with loyalty, but the dispatcher requests a shvuah.
Eliezer and Avram.
Eliezer and Avram, the same thing. I mean, it's, in some ways, it's even more shocking here because Zev is so committed. You know, the person isn't even named in Chayisar. He's so committed, he's nameless. He doesn't have an identity. And all of a sudden, Avram takes him Chevrolet. So this is based on a Gemara Nedarim. The Gemara Nedarim actually asks a question pretty similar to this. Amar of Gidol Amar Rav is on Zayin and Beis Chesem and Aleph. Minayin Shenishvayin L'Kayim is a mitzvah. Can you take a shvur to perform a mitzvah? And what's the Gemara's answer? Yes, because there's a pasuk in Tehillim. In Kuf Yutes, anyone know what makes Kuf Yutes unique? Tehillim? Why is it really, really long? Right. 8 psukim for each letter. 8 times 22 is 176. 8 psukim for each letter. Now, it's an important parak to know because the minhag is then when we recite Tehillim for a mace, whether at the Keber or during the Levaya, we try to recite their name. So if the name is David, I'm picking out a name, so I'll recite the Eip Sukkim of Dalet, the Eip Sukkim of Vav, the Eip Sukkim of Dalet, sometimes both names and sometimes Ben. So it's a parak you'll come to a lot. When you come to Kebers or when you come to a yard site and go to the Keber, the person's name is Aaron Aleph Hei Reishi. So in the Nun section of Kuf Yutes, David HaMelech writes the song, you know, the song Nishbati V'Akayema Lishmor Mishpatei Tzidkecha. It's an old song. Nishbati V'Akayema, I take a shvua and I fulfill. Lishmor Mishpatei, the short psukim, Lishmor Mishpatei Tzidkecha. So Rav Gidol Amarav proves from a pasuk into him. What's the hav? I mean, why do you need a pasuk? What's Rav Gidol? What's the drama? I mean, Nayin Shenishbayin L'Kayim. Here's the answer, and it's obvious once you say it. Why should I fulfill a mitzvah? Because I took a shvuah. Why should I fulfill a mitzvah? Tzivu Hashem, inherent reasons. When I'm overlaying a foreign incentive, such as a shvuah or neder, am I ruining the purity of my motivation and by extension the purity of the mitzvah? And the answer is, yeah, but practically it makes sense. Because even though the motivation may not be as pure as if it weren't overlaid with a shvuah, the chances for successful execution skyrocket. When you know you have to do it, or else you're going to be mevatel your shvuah, your word, your neder, and there's such a terrible severe answer. Which means that this gemara becomes a showcase for the balance between motivation and execution. And that's exactly what's happening in this week's parsha. Yaakov knows that Yosef wants to fulfill it out of pure love and loyalty. But things go sideways very often in life, especially if you're the king. And Yaakov is envisioning that Yosef's going to request permission from Paro to travel. Paro's like, I need you here. There's a big summit. Diplomats are coming from Morocco. We're fighting the Hittites. You can't go. I need you. Right. And Yaakov says, I'll tell you what. Here's your get out of jail free card. Blame it on me. You got to blame me. You got to do it because you have a shvuah. There's no ifs, ands, or buts. It's not relative. And that's another thing we think about a lot in life, and I'm sure you're thinking about right now in the middle. You know, Eli Weber calls it, everyone calls it, you got to fake it to make it. But in general, Chazal were aware, mitov shelo lishma ba lishma. And they validated shelo lishma. And the reason they validated shelo lishma is not just a mechanic, a trick to get, because in Yiddishkeit there are two realms. There's the realm of thought, feeling, and there's the realm of action. And they're both important. But here's the kicker. They're autonomous. What does it mean they're autonomous? What does that mean that the world of action is autonomous from the world of thought and feeling? Can anyone say that in a halachic way? Mitzvos, Ein, Srichos, Kavanah. There's a baseline of achievement. Now, obviously, the Kavanah is enriched and upgraded for sure. But if you fulfill the mitzvah, you fulfill the mitzvah. And motivation can change the caliber, change that. But there's a baseline. It's a very important part of Yiddishkeit. Very few religions, if any, exhibit. It's really a tripart balance between belief, what you believe in, your theology, internal thought, emotions, what you're thinking, and then your theology, like thinking inside, in action. What do I perform? It's a tripart table that's very, very solid. And think about in your own life, what are the type of external motivators that you see in other people? And what are the type of external motivators you want to use for yourself? So, for example, a really big one now at your age. Compare yourself to some of your friends at other yeshivas. Like, I don't know what's happening in other yeshivas, but you probably knew better than me. Some yeshivas thrive on more peer pressure. There's more pressure to conform, and everyone's doing one thing, and this is the way to go, and my way, the highway. So what's the drop-off of peer pressure? You certainly lack authenticity, for sure. It's not as authentic as you choose yourself, but how can you really trust 18 or 19-year-olds to find their own way? Just let people find their own way and choose their own path. Be a lot of fall-off, a lot of drainage. Chas v'shalom, we don't want drainage. So you may have to pay a price for authenticity. Let me say it this way. Conformity at this age provides a safe social container and gives you a chance to find authenticity later. And it is absolutely true that you'll never be as authentic if you come to it later. I've lived enough and I've seen enough people who try to get that personalization later, and it's an attached part of their identity rather than an integral part of their identity. It's fine, but isn't that better to just throw the doors wide open and let everyone choose and find themselves? Okay, so you have to find that magical balance between the two. But peer pressure is an external motivator. What else external motivates you? Contests, ego, right? How many? Ask you the following question. Is anything that you're doing this year based on ego? Because you want to be seen in a certain way. It's not really peer pressure where you feel pressure to do it. Ego is more, you choose to do it because you want to be seen. You want, okay, if it's arrogant and ostentatious and pugnacious, we don't like that. But if it's something internal, I want to be seen as a chazal were aware, cannot sell from Darbachach. That when there's a certain jealousy, not envy and hateful, I hate you and I want to be better than you, but I'm driven to. Sometimes boys who don't go back to Bate Medrash, so they'll ask me, how can I succeed in learning? So you know what a very interesting solution is? How can I learn in Colombia, let's say? A lot of people have told me that if you create a corrective mechanism of consequence, of effect and consequence, you're more likely to learn, which means as follows. If you tell yourself, every day I don't learn, I have to make up that time the next day. So like it's a Daf Yomi effect, it's going to start to aggregate. Or every day I don't learn, I have to find myself $5. So at a certain point, you have to pay the piper. And you get sick and tired of paying the piper, so you may have to, right? So those are extraordinary. Should you need the $5 fine to learn? Or should you need to have to make up to learn? No. But human nature is brittle. And we're all searching for that sweet spot between obligation, consequence. When you're young, obviously you need more consequences because that other side of authentic desire isn't yet developed. As you get more of that authenticity, so the consequence and the external motivators can shed, but not totally. And people on diets, I think, part of Weight Watchers is just consequences, motivation. People are going to hear you. People are going to see you. You have a coach. Anything that's difficult when you reduce. What about making a seum? Okay, that's a little bit of a lighter one. It's not external. People are going to laugh at me. But if you plan, I'm going to make a seum by Purim, by Pesach, by Yartzeit, you have to finish. And I can promise you, you'll finish it because you've imposed that deadline, just like term papers and deadlines. Otherwise, you'll tarry, you'll procrastinate. So should you need a seum to use every minute you have productively to finish a parak and shas? No, but by human nature, it can be helpful. Torah contests. Again, Torah contests are generally reserved for younger people, younger age. But even now, there's what's Bekiah splits and some people involved in that. And is it as pure? Shouldn't you be learning? And people are different. If you've got a lot of discipline and you can respond to that internal voice of authentic desire, so maybe you need less external motivator. But if you know yourself that you're a little bit weak in spirit and you tend to be lazy, you tend to procrastinate, sometimes imposing, no one should make a shvua, that's for sure. I want anyone making a shvua or neder. Sometimes imposing things that are like shvua and nedarim. Another couple, I'm just trying to give some practical advice. I think it's very healthy. Some boys have started at this stage of the year to write weekly divrei Torah for their family, for their friends, send out on emails. Doesn't have to be large, doesn't have to be big, but that obligates. That means, it's a clock. Every week it has to be put out, and I'm going to write. It could be a Dvar Torah on the Parsha. It could be something. Each week you share an idea you heard from some of the illustrious Rebbeim in Yeshiva. It could be a short Lamed Shavart that you, many, it doesn't have to be on the Parsha, but every week I'm going to write to my family something, L'Zecher, or when you go back. Seriously, when you go back to America, whatever that time is.
Best way to keep yourself in learning, seriously, every Shabbos, give a shiur too. Give a shiur to some high school kids younger than you. Give a shiur to, because if you know you have to produce, it must, now again, should you only learn Torah because you have to give the shiur? Of course not. But human nature is that if you know there's a deadline, you have to produce a certain finished product. And it can be something as simple as teaching Mishnayos, or most of you, by the time you finish 2 years here in Yeshiva, you'll, if you're here for 2 years, you'll be fully, fully capable of giving a reasonable lambda shiur to many, many different levels of people in your community. I've had a lot of success with people going back to communities, and they say, I'm moving too. So the first thing you should do is gather the high school kids, Shabbos, Mincha, Ma'ariv, give them a 30-minute lambda shiur. Just pick a topic and just show them what Gemara is, because high school deadens our appreciation of Gemara for many, many people. So many people are confused about Gemara in high school. If you can break that lock hold and get them to see that some beauty of Gemara. I have a friend who's about 10 years older than me who's been doing this in Teaneck for close to 30 years. And he's produced, through his interaction in Rinat, in the show of Rinat, he's produced tons of Talmidei Chachamim and probably close to 10, 12 Mechanchim. And obviously a lot of people were involved. Not only he produced it, but he gave them that early exposure. Okay, so the two things tonight is specialization versus focus, concentration, and external motivators versus internal drive and desire. Okay, so two things to toss around in your mind. Okay. I'll put the Rav Aaron quote up on the list, Rav.
Thank you, Rav.
You're welcome.